feet and daylight unto my path. And a light unto, a light unto my path, my path.
Welcome to Searchlight, a survey through Scripture with Pastor John Corson. It is our desire to bring you a systematic study of the entire Bible, chapter by chapter, book by book. As we continue our study in the book of Judges, we are going to see that words really make a difference. In fact, in our story, we will see that one single word made the difference between life and death, between entering into victory and going down in defeat. The story is from Judges chapter 12, and it's the continuation of the adventures of Jephthah. Jephthah was one of the judges, that is, leaders, that God raised up to deliver the people of Israel. This is quite a fascinating story with a practical illustration and application for us. So let's now join Pastor John and see what a difference a word makes.
We take our text from Judges chapter 12. You see, chapter 12 of Judges is actually a continuation of the story that we looked at last Sunday. You might remember from our story last time how a man named Jephthah, a tough hombre, a guy who was head of the Tob mob, he lived in Tob, and he had a group of guys around him that were pretty macho kind of men. And the people of Israel were being harassed and harangued by the people of Ammon, the Ammonites, another country, another nation. Year after year went by, and finally they cried unto the Lord, the people of Israel did. And the Lord was moved by their prayer and mobilized them, that is, the people of Israel, to get engaged, involved, and taken on the men of Ammon, these oppressors, these enemies. They needed, though, a man to lead the army of Israel. And there was no man found in the major portion of Israel that was able to lead the army. They had grown rather weak and soft and flabby, if you would, and there was not a man found in the land to lead the army. But then they remembered, but there's a guy up north on the east side of the Jordan River in a place called Gilead, in a town called Tob. His name is Jephthah. We kicked him out of our country. We kicked him out of our community. But he's been up there, and his reputation is well known. He's a tough guy. And so they called on Jephthah, the man from Tob, to come and lead the army of Israel against the Ammonites. Remember the story? And Jephthah did just that. At first he tried to negotiate a peace, but when that didn't work, he was ready to engage the Ammonites in battle. And before the battle began, he prayed a prayer, "Lord, if you grant me victory, I will offer to you the first thing that comes out of my house when I get back home again." He was thinking, no doubt, it would be a cow, a goat, a bull, a ram, some kind of an animal. But when he was victorious, Jephthah, and they had beaten the Ammonites soundly, Jephthah goes back to his house, but instead of a cow or a bull or a ram or a lamb greeting him, it was his daughter who came out. Oh, his heart was broken. Evidently, he didn't think she would be there. Away at school, maybe, or at the mall, or went to the beach or something, but there she was. And we talked about that story in our last session. For application or amplification of that. You can pick up last Sunday's tape if you choose to. But now the story continues on in chapter 12. In chapter 12, after the battle against Ammon had been successfully concluded, we read in verse 1, the men of Ephraim, a tribe in Israel. These are Israelites. Now, just like we have states, we have Oregon and California, New Jersey and Florida. So in Israel, they had 12 tribes. And the men from Ephraim, one of the tribes, or we would say one of the states in our country, these are men of Israel too, they gathered themselves together and went up north where Jephthah was. And they said to Jephthah, this guy that just had led the armies of Israel to victory, wherefore passest thou over to fight against the children of Ammon, and didst not call us to go with thee? We will burn thine house upon thee with fire. They were hot. They were burning up. The men of Ephraim said, we're going to fire you, Jephthah. Literally. We're going to ignite your house on fire when you're in there sleeping or having dinner or whatever you might be doing. We are angry with you. We are burning with rage toward you. And we've come here to fire you. Literally. To fire you from being the general, the big kahuna, the head honcho, whatever. We're upset. Why were they upset? Jephthah said to those guys, verse 2, Jephthah says, what do you mean that we didn't call you to go with us into battle? Jephthah said, I and my people were at great strife with the children or the nation of Ammon. And when I called you, you delivered me not out of their hand. And when I saw that you delivered me not, I put my life in my own hands and passed over against the children of Ammon. And the Lord delivered them into my hand. So why then are you come up to me this day to fight against me? Hey, Jephthah said protestingly, I did call for you. A message had gone out, and you guys from Ephraim, you didn't respond. You didn't come when you had the opportunity. You didn't respond to the invitation sent from me. And now that we've had victory, you're angry and you're mad because you didn't come? Perhaps this rings a bell in your memory. See, back in chapter 8 of the same book, when Gideon won a glorious victory over the Midianites, maybe you recall the story of Gideon. It was the same tribe, the same guys that came out and said to Gideon, how come you didn't use us? What's the big idea? These guys from Ephraim are just basically loud-mouthed troublemakers. Ever met a person like that? These guys are just agitators. Oh, they're men of Israel, but they keep on protesting and getting mad and being upset because they felt as though they were left out. Jephthah said, you were not left out. You knew the situation. And I called for you before that confrontation, and you didn't respond. So now that there's been a great victory and the spoils have been divvied out, that's why you're upset. Not because you wanted to be in the battle, but you wanted the blessing. You wanted the goodies. And Jephthah says, hey, you're wrong, man. You were given the opportunity and you didn't come. So then, Jephthah, unlike Gideon, who with a soft answer negotiated a peace with these loud-mouthed Ephraimites, Jephthah, the tough guy, is going to teach him a lesson. So Jephthah, verse 4, gathered together all the men of Gilead, the region where he was from, the area up north and to the east of the Jordan River, outside of the proper boundary of Israel. And yet that's where some of the people of Israel chose to live. So he gathered those guys, and he went to war, verse 4, with Ephraim. And the men of Gilead, that's Jephthah's region, smote Ephraim. Smoked him, man. Because they said, you Gileadites, you guys from Jephthah's place, you're fugitives or outcasts of Ephraim and among the Manassites. You're outcasts. You don't even fit in with us on this side of the Jordan River. That's why you live over there. You're outcasts. You are, we would say today, the scum of the earth. We can't stand you. You make us sick. That's what the men of Ephraim said. Well, the Gileadites, led by Jephthah, they said, well, we'll show you a thing or two. And they went to war against him and smoked him. And the Gileadites, led by Jephthah, had a resounding victory. And then, verse 5, they took the passages, or the fords, also the Chevys, of the Jordan. Pardon me. Well, he drove his Chevy to the levee, but it was dry. So he went and took the ford, you see. And what he did here was kind of, pardon me. But what he did here was kind of amazing, because after they mix it up, Jephthah sends the Gileadites, his boys, round back behind the men of Ephraim, because the men of Ephraim crossed over the Jordan into the region of Jephthah and Gilead. So now Jephthah says to his boys, go on the backside and let's close off their route of escape. We'll surround them. So now the men of Ephraim have been wiped out and they're running for their lives to cross back over the Jordan again to get away, to get back home to their own territory, their own tribal area, you see. But Jephthah has his men there by the fords, by the places where you can cross over the Jordan. And when they saw men, verse 5 says, it was so when those Ephraimites, which did escape from the wipeout, the battle, and they said, let's go back over again. The men of Gilead, who were there guarding the fords or the passages or the crossing places, said, are you an Ephraimite? Because you see, they're all men of Israel. So, are you an Ephraimite? And if the guy said, no, I'm not an Ephraimite. I'm just crossing over here. I'm one of you guys, you see. Then, verse 6, they said to that guy who said, no, I'm not an Ephraimite, then say Shibboleth. Shibboleth means literally river or stream. Say Shibboleth. And he said, Sibboleth, because the men from Ephraim could not pronounce sh, you see. They had a different kind of accent, and they just couldn't say Shibboleth. All they could say was Sibboleth. It was a regional accent. If you don't get the idea, ask Judy Slaughter, our dear friend from Boston. She has lots of good ideas about these kinds of things. There are... Judy, are you here? I forgive me. I love your Bostonian, Massachusettsian thing. You know, it's great and grand. But you can identify where a person is from by the way they say or can't say certain words. So that's what these guys did here. It's an amazing thing. The men from Gilead are there guarding the river so the Ephraimites don't cross back over the Jordan into their region. Are you from Ephraim? Oh, no. Then say Shibboleth. And the guy said, Sibboleth. He couldn't say it. He couldn't pronounce it. Then said they unto him, say now Shibboleth. But he said Sibboleth, for he could not frame to pronounce it right. He couldn't say it. He couldn't pronounce it. They took him and slew him there at the passage of Jordan. And there fell at that time of the Ephraimites 42,000 men. 42,000 wiped out in battle and wiped out trying to escape over the Jordan. They couldn't do so. They couldn't make it into their home territory because they didn't pronunciate or enunciate one word correctly. Listen to me. One word cost them their lives. One word made the difference between living or dying, between being free to cross over into their destiny or being cut off and killed brutally. One word. Their destiny was hinged on a single word, you see. Could they say it? And if they couldn't say Shibboleth, because they couldn't pronounce it right, but only Sibboleth, then they were dealt with that day, that night. Words make a difference, folks. One word can make the difference in your destiny between life and death. A single word, a single pronunciation can make the difference concerning what your destiny will be now and eternally. One single word. Language. Language can open up doors or it can slam them shut. Words make a difference. I think of that story back in the 1860s. It's true, I'm told. I don't know. But there was a bandito that was living in Mexico, would cross over the border into Texas and into New Mexico, and he would rob banks and hold up trains and steal from the Wells Fargo stage line and all the rest. He was notorious. No one could seem to catch this bandito. For years, a certain marshal had been trying to track him down, this federal marshal. Couldn't do so. But one day, lo and behold, there in El Paso, the federal marshal walks into the bar and he sees the bandito sitting there at the table playing poker. He can't believe his luck. He walks up stealthily, quietly behind the bandito and he draws, this ranger draws his six shooter and puts it right there behind his skull, the bandito's skull. And he says, "Stop right there, bandito." And the bandito froze and dropped his cards and put up his hands. The marshal knew the bandito didn't speak much English. Anybody in this bar speaks Spanish and English? Can translate for me? The bartender said, I can. Come over here. Tell this guy his number's up. Tell this guy he's under arrest. Tell this guy, though, before I take him in, I want to know where he's hidden the gold that he's taken from Wells Fargo and from the railroad and from the banks. I want to know where the gold is. Tell him if he doesn't confess right now, right here, I'm going to put a bullet through his skull. And so the bartender, who was the interpreter, said to the bandito, "Hey, the marshal, he wants to know where you hid the gold, where the goods are." And the bandito said, tell the marshal, "Guadalajara, right there in the town square across from the casino, there's a well. The well is empty, but at the bottom of the well, there's a strong box, and that's where all the gold is. Tell him, tell him." And the translator turned to the marshal and said, "Marshal, the bandito says he'll never tell you or anyone, and he's ready to die. Put that bullet in his head right now if you can." Words can enrich you. Language can make all the difference, you see. As that bartender found out, hey, he knew, and he went his way and became a rich man that day when he uncovered and brought up the stolen goods. Words. Words can enrich. They can open doors, or words can slam shut doors too. Speaking of Mexico, my goodness. Words, how you need to know how to say stuff if you want to have things open up for you. I was in college at Biola as a freshman, and we were pledging for a fraternity kind of group, Alpha Omega Chi. And it was interesting because, well, they put the pledges, the first year guys, through this, what they called Hades Week. And Hades week was all, you know, you had to walk around everywhere all week long with raw eggs in your pockets, all pockets, six raw eggs minimally at any given time. And when one of the actives, one of the guys in the fraternity saw you, he would come up and say, "Hey, how you doing?" and slap you, you know, in the chest or in the pockets where the raw eggs were, you see. And the yoke was on us and all that. And that was a crack up, I thought. Sorry about that. Shall we stop? Be that as it may, white on. But these eggs are just kind of running down and all over all week long. You know how that goes. And, oh, we had to carry around a cardboard box everywhere for that week, too, and a broom. And whenever an active or a fraternity guy said, "Air raid," no matter what class we were in, no matter what we were doing, we had to get in the box and take the broom and shoot down imaginary airplanes, you know. So here we are, you know, at any time in the middle of the quad or in the dining hall or whatever, air raid, you know, and all. And then, of course, that night they take you out, and we had to, in La Mirada there, close to the college, there was a dairy. And this dairy was big. And they kept all the manure in this huge, huge mountainous pile. And so the active guys, the fraternity guys, would make us go through at nighttime, and we had to tunnel through this pile of manure with our hands and crawl all the way through. And let me tell you, there was no pony in there, I can guarantee. So, you know, all week long, this kind of stuff goes on. If you've been part of a fraternity or those kinds of groups, you know about that kind of stuff. And, well, when we were finally pledged in, we had one day to revenge ourselves. So me and a couple of three guys, we grabbed one of the fellas that was most brutal to us, and his name was Dave. And we grabbed him, and we laid this plot out to capture him, because the active guys for one day were all hiding away and very careful about, you know, staying away from us, because there was one day of revenge. We grabbed him. He made a mistake, a tactical error. He let his girlfriend know where he was going to be. And we got to the girl, bribed her, and all the rest. And anyway, we apprehended Dave, put him in the back of our van. One of the guys had a van, and we drove him from Biola, La Mirada, down to Tijuana. And at that time, this was back in 71, 72, Tijuana was still, not like it is today, a major city. It was still a border town. And so we took Dave down there, and you see, well, the next day was the beginning of spring finals. And so it was real important, you know, to be studying that night and be there the next day and the next couple of days for classes, because it was final exams for the spring term. And so we got Dave, and we thought, you know, he was real always into grades, and this guy, he was a strong guy, tough guy, but good student, prided himself in his scholastic achievements. Ah, this is great. We stripped off his clothes. He only had boxer shorts on. And we took him with just his boxers down there to Tijuana and took him across the border into the heart of Tijuana, that border town, and dumped him off.
What? Pastor John did that? We'll have to find out the outcome of this story on our next program, because we've run out of time for today. It is likely that we will hear a practical spiritual application to this crazy story at that time, so please join us then.
This teaching is also available on the Searchlight website at johncorson.com. You will also find on the website Pastor John's books and other Bible study resources. Again, the address of the website is johncorson.com.
Most of us desire to spend more time in prayer, just talking with the Lord and hearing from Him. But we often struggle in this area of prayer. In order to help us have a more consistent and effective prayer life, Pastor John has a book called Praying Through the Tabernacle. This book shows us a model of prayer that is based on the Old Testament tabernacle. This is a very practical tool for everyone who desires an intimate walk with the Lord. You may order Praying Through the Tabernacle from the Searchlight website at johncorson.com.
Searchlight is an independent ministry that is not financially supported by any church or organization. We appreciate your prayers and support. May the Lord richly bless you.